Hey everyone, Adam D. from Indefensive Ska here. A little note before we start the show. Los Angeles is dealing with multiple catastrophic fires. A lot of people have lost their homes and are in need. If you're able to help, please do so. There are a lot of great organizations you can donate to, like California Fire Foundation, Pasadena Humane Society, Mutual Aid LA, and there's even a list of people in the music industry that have lost their homes. Links are in the show notes for our Rob Harvilla episode. Thanks. Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in its expanded second edition.
All right, today I want to talk about the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, not just ska. I want to talk about the 90s.
Okay, what's when you think of the 90s, what's the most 90s song you can think of?
It's hard to like top Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. That's, to me, that seems like the most defining 90s song. But I think of 90s more as early to mid 90s.
Sure, yeah. And that's kind of a cool like early 90s song. But like I would say like, you know, a less cool late 90s earworm would be Steal My Sunshine by Len.
Oh yeah, I used to when I lived in Las Vegas in like 99, I used to deliver pizzas for Domino's. And there was this one school that I delivered pizzas to pretty regularly, and that song was always playing in the gymnasium.
Amazing.
Yeah, it definitely converted me. I hated that song, then I loved it.
So our guest today probably has a pretty good grasp on this topic.
Oh, yeah. Rob Harvilla, he has a podcast called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, which eventually became a book. And each episode focuses on a single song from the 90s that defined the decade in some way. And he kind of takes that and kind of like expands upon it, looks at the culture and music in general. Such a success, in fact, that he made 120 episodes. And he recently ended the show and he's moved on to the 2000s. Rob, by the way, is a longtime music critic. I can remember reading his stuff like decades ago, honestly. There's a quote from him in my second edition of In Defense of Ska. There's a section about Vampire Weekend and how the music critic world sort of responded to them and their hints of ska in the late 2000s. So he was one music critic that I found kind of pointing out their ska-ness back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So of the 120 episodes that Rob did, how many of those were for a ska song?
So technically, no. Although I guess it's debatable. He did Just a Girl by No Doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Not technically a ska song, but they're a band with ska roots. And so he used that as a jumping off point to talk about ska in the 90s pretty extensively. But in my opinion, he still missed out on an actual 90s ska song in his entire run of the episode.
So if Rob was going to do some ska episodes, what do you think would be good contenders from the 90s?
I mean, I think the songs that people know, I think we're looking at songs that people outside of ska know. And that would be like, what, Sell Out by Real Big Fish?
Mm-hmm.
Come On Eileen by Say Ferris?
Well, actually by...
well, they're talking about the 90s version.
Sure, yes, yes.
Here in the Bedroom by Goldfinger. I don't know. What do you think? Is there other big like ska singles from the 90s?
Those are the big ones, I think. Yeah.
Okay. But the biggest, the impression that I get by the Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's the song that like people who have no connection to 90s ska will bring up and know. In fact, I think an interesting fact about that song is it's the only 90s ska song that hit number one on the Billboard charts.
So we didn't get that episode in 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, but what are we going to do now?
Oh, we're going to do that episode ourselves. And we're going to bring on Rob as our guest to discuss the impression that I get as a 90s defining song.
Yeah, let's bring on Rob and see where ska truly lands in 90s pop culture.
Rob, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
Before we get started on our topic, you were in a ska band, right?
Thank you. Bless you. Bless you for starting with this. This is the most important thing I have to convey today, that yes, I was in a ska band, and I'm very proud of that fact. I was in a ska band called Scantily Plaid, SK, and of course, I'm very proud of that name. I didn't come up with that name, but I'm just proud to be at all associated with that name. We performed live 3 times at Ohio University in, I want to say the winter and spring of 1997. So like right in the Mighty Mighty Bosstones Real Big Fish boom, right? I was the bass player. I was not very good. I did write one song that was called Rob's Song that I can still remember. I can still remember the bass line, at least in my head sometimes. But yeah, we played like 3 shows. We were not successful in any commercial or artistic or spiritual sense, but it's I cherish that experience deeply. Absolutely.
Wait, so Rob's Song, was that an instrumental or did it have lyrics?
It had lyrics. I wrote lyrics. That's right. I wrote lyrics. I went to a show. Okay, so there was at Ohio University, there was a really fantastic local ska band called The Beatdowns.
That's a good name.
That's a really good name. They were really, really good. And then most of the other guys in Scantily Plaid were from Beaver Creek, Ohio, and they had a band there called the Crusty Watch Guys. This is very important context. I don't know if that was a ska band or if that was more of they crossed genres. They couldn't be contained, the Crusty Watch Guys. And so we were at a ska show, you know, because of the Beatdowns, like ska bands would come and play, like Skank and Pickle, I think, came, and a few other bands. And I feel like I thought I stole the bass line from them, but then I couldn't find it again. But the bass line was just do 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 do. And then I wrote lyrics that were just really dumb, really stupid. It's like, gotta understand the way I think I feel about you. That's not quite it, but it's not much better than that. So there were lyrics, but it's better if you didn't focus on the lyrics and you just, the rad bass line was really the whole point of Rob's Song in my memory.
I did read the tweet where you said Scantily Plaid, and I was going to say it, but I was like, I wasn't actually sure if that was a joke or if that was the real name.
That is, it's absolutely the real name. It's one of the, it's probably the most important thing I did in college, if we're being honest right now. Probably the most relevant to my current career was being in Scantily Plaid for half an hour freshman year.
All right. So today we want to kind of investigate whether the impression that I get by the Mighty Mighty Bosstones is a song that helps, is a song that defines the 90s. And this is what we wanted you on to see.
Mm.
It did not make your show, but
it didn't, and I'm very ashamed of that fact. Actually, in retrospect, there's a few, you know, I love it when people yell at me for the songs they think I should have put on but didn't. But there are like 3 to 5 that I really genuinely agree. It's like Stone Temple Pilots. I don't know how that didn't happen. Bush didn't happen. Glycerine probably, and that should happen. But like I should have. The impression that I get was on the long list forever. I almost did it several billion times. I can almost assure you, you would have been the guest if we had done it. So that's also very heartbreaking. But I absolutely should have done it. I am absolutely of the opinion that it is a song that defines the 90s. So let's call it. I did 120 songs, so it is the 121st song.
All right, it's official.
It's official. You can write it down.
Now, my point of view, I'm curious if you agree, if we were to pick a ska song, this would be the ska song, right? Or do you think that a different one?
I think so. I think there are candidates. I think Sell Out is really interesting.
Sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. The record company's only give me lots of money and everything's gonna be alright.
You know, and just the sort of dilemma residing, animating that song is very fascinating to me. It's like they sort of It's not that they understand they're going to be one-hit wonders or whatever, but like so much of third wave ska and that weird ska boom, you know, the anxiety behind it is sort of tied up in that song. There's sort of like a meta aspect to it. Like, do you consider Goldfinger's Here in Your Bedroom to be ska? When I wake up tomorrow, would you still feel the same? When I wake up tomorrow, would you have changed? Cause I still feel the same. Cause I still feel the same.
Yeah, I consider that. I consider that enough of a ska song. It's definitely like a ska punk song for sure.
Yeah. So like there are candidates, like I did no doubt, right? You know, and like you kind of got to go like this when you assert that No Doubt might be kind of ska. Like there are other possibilities, but I, on another level, no, I think it's the pretty clear if you're doing one. You know, I like Someday I Suppose better. But I don't think you can argue that that was more impactful. It certainly wasn't a bigger hit in any qualitative sense, but I do think, you know, I think the impression that I get is the one. Absolutely. How about you? You're the expert. You're wearing a shirt that says I love ska. It's very impressive. So like, what do you think? That's what's important here.
Now, if you asked me in the 90s, I probably wouldn't say that just because I was so entrenched in like the music that I liked.
Absolutely.
I like the Boston's a lot. Especially like Someday I Suppose. And I thought Royal Oil was a better song from this record.
Yeah.
But nowadays, when I talk to people or I listen to people who really were not in touch with ska at all, they know this song.
They do. They really do.
So this is the song that rose above the rest in terms of like, you know, getting outside of the ska scene, outside of the ska bubble. So for that reason, I think it represents 90s ska the most in culture. So
I agree.
And I think the band deserved the success they got. So I have no qualms with Mighty Mighty Bosstones being the band that had the biggest hit. This is, you know, this was the only number one hit ska song from the 90s.
It was number one.
It was number one on the modern rock chart.
Right. But still, yeah, it's, why do you think that is? I don't want to jump too far ahead if that's the whole thesis here, but like it's a good song. It's a catchy song. You know, I guess I understand why it works on alt rock radio. Like it blends in a little better than even some of the biggest, you know, of the other great Boston songs. But like, it is very weird that this one has risen so far above not even the Boston's discography, but like that boom of ska in general. Like, what quality does this song have that made it the one?
All right, yeah, let's kind of analyze that.
Yeah,
okay.
What do you think of when I mention the song? What's like the first thing or a couple things that pops in your head about this song?
I think if you just came up to me on the street and said the impression that I get, like the song would start playing. And from the beginning, like I'd hear the guitar.
Yeah.
I'd hear the horns. I'd hear like the drums come in, you know, and like the ska of it all assert itself. I would hear, one of my favorite part of this song is still the no. Well, like just something about the pre-chorus is just fascinating to me. Right, like it's an like it's just no well and and it works so well. It's just so bizarre. But like, I hear the song complete, you know, and I guess like the distortion kicks in on the chorus. Like again, like you can put that, you know, after a Rancid song, you know, between a Rancid song and like a Smashing Pumpkin song. Like I hear the song complete and I hear that it's got as much alt rock energy as ska energy. But there isn't one part of the song other than the pre-chorus that jumps out at me. It feels complete, you know, and it feels true to both them, but both really primed to be on the radio. Was it 96?
97.
97. Okay. Yeah. It seems primed to be on the radio in 97.
Yeah. I think that pre-chorus scream is probably the best moment of the song for me.
Okay. We agree there. All right. Excellent.
But I agree. Like, there's so many elements, like the opening lick. Like, if you hear that opening lick, mm-hmm. you know immediately what song it is.
That's right. That's right.
And that horn line, very, very iconic. Yeah. I feel like I don't really feel like I even listen to radio much at this time, but I know this song backwards and forwards.
Right.
So I must have just heard it out and about. I just probably just heard the song over and over again.
Yeah. I'm even forgetting now, like, what kickstarted like the ska mini boom in the first place? Like, was it No Doubt? Was it Goldfinger?
Yeah, let's go through ska in the mainstream.
Okay. Yes.
And what's interesting about the impression that I get is kind of at the end of it, really.
Yeah.
It's its biggest moment, and it's kind of its final moment a little bit. It kind of fades out a little bit. But No Doubt, not really ska, but related to ska, comes out in 95. Date Rape by Sublime, I think, is the first legit single on the radio that's ska.
Yeah.
And Time Bomb comes out by Rancid. That comes around the same time.
Yeah.
So these are both 95. No Doubt's 95 as well. 96, you have Here in the Bedroom by Goldfinger. Real Big Fish, that record comes out in 96. I'm a little confused about whether Sellout came out in 96 or 97. I think it really started to hit in 97, though.
I think at least it really started to hit in 97. That sounds right to me, that it was out in 96, but it wasn't a phenomenon until 97.
And Sublime, too, like, their record comes out, I think, 96. But I think, like, if you were to parse out the one ska single that hit, which would be Wrong Way, I think that is, like, also 97.
Yeah, that's like the third or fourth single off that record. Yeah.
And then you have Save Ferris, Come On Eileen. I think that's 97 also.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, you know, and then you have like some within that whole time period, you have some minor singles. Like, you have Buck 09, My Town.
Ooh.
Voodoo Glow Skulls. Like,
yeah.
They had a few songs that kind of got a little bit of MTV play. Dancehall Crashers had a little bit there too.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fading out in 98, you have, I think Less Than Jake finally had a, like, History of a Boring Town kind of got a little bit.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, The Specials had a single in 98 that charted.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember that. That's cool. That's apt.
It's, yeah, well, I don't know. Like, 90s Specials isn't that great. So.
Yeah, that's true. I guess so. Good for them, though.
Good for that. Yeah, good for that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think no, nothing really in 99. I think by 99, we're pretty much out of this.
Right. Okay.
So here's an interesting, just a little side tangent. I was looking up some Spin did an article a few years back about the best alt-rock songs of the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they had impression that I get is number 12.
Ooh, that's pretty good. Top 12.
That's pretty good. Just below Meredith Brooks' Bitch and just above Sugar Ray's Fly.
Wow.
I know.
Bitch almost cracked the top 10. It's very impressive. It smells like Teen Spirit number one, or are we being iconoclastic here in general? Spin.
I mean, how could Smells Like Teen Spirit not be number one?
You would think so.
Yeah.
It'd be funny if number one was Sell Out by Real Big Fish. That would be the most appropriate thing. Just
it would be. In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
When you think about ska in the 90s, do you also think about swing? Do you think of these things together, or do you think of them separately?
I think of them as separate entities, but that weirdly sort of hit simultaneously, right? And this is all happening. It's my freshman year of college, right? I'm at Ohio University, you know, like I'm trying to get on college radio, you know, we've got MTV on in our dorm room, you know. And I remember, like, I read Rolling Stone and Spin religiously at the time, and what they're pushing is electronica, right? Like the Chemical Brothers, the Prodigy, you know, Fatboy Slim, you know, not all of that is hitting immediately, but like that kind of thing, Underworld, like that's where they think music is going. And I remember somehow I understood the idea that ska was this weird, unexpected, unplanned, like this is the thing that hit instead for some reason. And yeah. I don't know if partly, you know, if that's sort of the long tail of No Doubt or whatever, but suddenly like ska is the big thing, like very unexpectedly. It has this insurgent quality to it. But like I'm hanging out with the Crusty Watch guys, right? I'm hanging around with this band of like at least ska friendly people, rockers. And this band, again, it's like, it's Ohio University, like it's not a big campus, it's not really having any effect on the outside world, but like within OU, like this band, the Beatdowns, was huge, man. Like we would go see them, the shows would be sold out, they were so good. I remember them so fondly. And so I don't think they're at all related to the 1996 ska boom, right? And so it's this weird, I have this sense that things are changing both like on campus and on MTV at the same time. But I do think that the Cherry Pop and Daddies of it all was pretty immediately after that. You know, like I remember, you know, my early years on college radio, like playing the Squirrel Nut Zippers, you know, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Like it felt like sort of the sidecar to the ska boom. I don't know how if that actually was, but it did feel like these two things hit like more or less simultaneously. And they were both sort of delightfully bizarre, you know, and exciting.
Yeah, I think the common denominator for the U.S. pop culture in the 90s was horns.
Yes, right, right.
I think that's the thing that like kind of connected to people. Whether or not there was musical like similarities, I think it's just people weren't used to seeing horns in like alt rock bands.
Yeah, and then, you know, like swingers, obviously, you know, the neo-swing movement has like a more definitive ground zero. Like this is the moment where it really sort of clicked. And that's Big Bad Voodoo Daddy with on stage at the end of Swingers. You know, I don't think is there a cinematic equivalent? What is the greatest ska moment in movie history? You know, like, I don't know if there is one in the same way.
Yeah, it's not really the same way, but I guess we would probably point at Mighty Mighty Boss Tone's cameo in Clueless would be my.
That was important.
It was important. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew even before I'd heard them that like the Boss Tones were a revered live act before I knew anything else about it. Like they're from Boston and they're fantastic live. And if you know them, you love them, you know, and you just, when you get it, you get it. Like I knew that, you know, Someday I Suppose was probably the first song of theirs that I heard that was on the radio. And that was probably in the mid 90s, you know, that's before everything really pops off.
Yeah. Let's go. I'm going to give like a real brief breakdown of their history leading up to the song. Okay. Feel free to interject as you wish.
Okay.
Boston's. So they formed all the way back in 83. They were like kids at the time.
Yeah.
They broke up in 87, but then they reformed in 89. But when they reformed in 89, they were serious in a way they weren't before.
Yes.
They got a deal with Tang Records that year. I think it was related to their reforming. They put out The Devil's Night Out. They did a few records. They got the, I don't know if you remember their Converse commercial. Do you remember that in 91?
Ooh, their Converse commercial. I don't believe I do. In 91?
Yeah, so this was when they were still indie artists. It was a very unusual deal. I think it had to do with like friends or connections. And so they were on TV in 91 from Converse. And what they told me when Nate Albert was on the show with us, he said that it helped kind of like, it helped get them on the road a lot. It gave them like enough money to kind of be able to make that choice to be like road dogs.
Sure.
And so they pivoted towards really taking it seriously. Their first tour, by the way, was with Murphy's Law. It's an interesting pairing.
All right.
Yeah. I Don't Know How to Party, the song was written after they toured with them because they realized that they did not know how to party when it came to Murphy's Law.
Very, very literal. Very honest.
Yeah, very okay. Literal.
I don't know how to party. That's good. That's really good.
Yeah. Not a metaphor.
Yeah.
they got signed to Mercury in 93, which seems pretty early to me. I mean,
yeah.
This is before punk rock even got signed. You know, bands like Green Day, I think, was 94. So
Dookie was 94. Yeah, you know, like it's so like Nevermind happens in 91 and there is like this burst, you know, that's the alt rock gold rush, right? That's when everybody and their mother gets signed. And so I think by that way of thinking, if they are enough alt rock to be regarded, you know, as part of this boom, then yeah, I guess that does make sense to get signed around 93. But obviously, yeah, 94 is Dookie, it's Smash. You know, that's when the punk rock of it all really sort of takes over from grunge as like the next big thing, right?
Yeah, I guess part of why they were signed was because they were such a big deal in Boston specifically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And kids would just be wrapped around the block, like, you know, lining up to see their shows. And they were all dressed in plaid, too. So I think that Danny Goldberg from Mercury saw that and was kind of like, he knew there was some sort of phenomenon happening. He didn't really understand it. He didn't know anything about ska. He didn't really know what they were, but he understood that like they were a force that had like this rabid fan base.
But even within Seattle, like I don't know if there's a lot of other bands that have that rabid local fan base, mm-hmm. right? Where you can see like physical proof of how big this band is. You know, and you come across it and you don't understand what it is, you know, and like, but you see that all these other people do, like, that's a vanishing thing, even by the mid-90s, you know, and at least in my head, like, the internet sort of blows that up entirely. But just the idea of regional, of local heroes, you know, that have this huge phenomenon that if you don't know anything about it, you don't know anything about it. But if you do, it's your entire universe. Like, that's just a very cool idea and a cool foundation to start from, you know, as opposed to just coming from nowhere, you know, having nothing and just getting signed to a major label, you know, because you have distorted guitars or whatever.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, I remember seeing them before the impression that I get. And they were pretty big as a sort of scene band who had that sort of major label support, but weren't really like, quote unquote, a major label or weren't like a mainstream band because they didn't have that hit.
They're not on MTV, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Someday, I suppose, was a minor hit, but they were playing like the biggest clubs. You know, they seemed like the biggest ska band to me at the time.
I think they were probably. I mean, I defer to you entirely, but yeah.
Them and like Skank and Pickle, oddly, were quite big as an underground band. They were playing big venues.
Yeah.
But probably because of their label and their like fan base, they did the, you know, Clueless in 95. They got on Lollapalooza in 95 as well.
Oh, I forgot about that. What year? Who was the headliner of Lollapalooza 95?
Beck, Jesus Lizard, Cypress Hill, Sonic one. Youth, Pavement. I don't remember who the headliner was, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they were like a main stage like opener or something like that.
Yeah. It's a good way to start it off.
So they had a couple major label records. And then I think they did all the stuff I just mentioned. And then ska starts to hit.
Hmm.
And then it's a couple years before they release Let's Face It. So when they released the record before Let's Face It, ska hadn't really hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they come out with Let's Face It, ska is like a legitimate mainstream genre at that point.
Right.
So they come out the gate with Let's Face It record with ska kind of already being like this, there's a buzz around ska.
Are they making this record with the idea that like this is, you know, this is our time, this is our window, you know, are they sort of conscious of that when they're making Let's Face It, I wonder?
From what they told me, yes, they were aware of it.
Okay, all right.
Nate told me that while they were working on it, they heard Rancid's And Out Come the Wolves, and it kind of like was a big inspiration for them. Like, wow, this record is really good. It's really well produced.
Yeah.
Like, I think it was a little bit of a like, we want to make our And Out Come the Wolves. So.
Right, right.
Like, and also if you listen to Boston's catalog, they're kind of weird songwriters, and their production
leading up to Let's Face It, their production was always kind of odd.
Hmm.
But the production on Let's Face It's so much slicker.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, if you heard, you know, the striving, right, yeah.
So yeah, they did that pretty consciously, from what I've gathered, that they were trying to make like a much more straightforward album. They tried to make a production that was a little bit more friendly to radio and stuff, and you know, I think it worked. You know, it radio accepted the record.
They really did. I wonder how much better it was for them that they had this foundation, right? Like they'd already, this is a better question. I would love to know your thoughts on the crowd and the vibe pre and post the impression. Are you surrounded by posers now? Are you surrounded by people at the post impression I get show where, you know, like you just got into ska like 2 months ago, right? Like, is there a lot of that energy either internally or externally at the first Boss Tones show you see after they blow up?
Now, I didn't see them after they blew up. Adam, did you ever see Boss Tones kind of after they blew up?
Does Lollapalooza 95 count?
No.
Then no.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, they were everywhere after Impression That I Get, and they were playing like Warped Tour, and they were playing all these festivals, and they were like,
yeah,
they were like, I feel like Impression was on MTV like constantly for like a stretch of time. It was on like a ton of movie soundtracks too.
I'm sure that's true. I was trying to remember one and I can't. There's got to be a Jim Carrey movie with that song in it. That it doesn't make sense to me if there isn't, honestly.
There is, actually.
Yeah, sure. It's like Dumb and Dumber or something. Sure. Yeah.
We'll look it up. We'll come back to that. But yeah, I think that is the case. And I think it was on like TV. You know, here's a funny side note, and it relates to this and how it penetrated culture. There is a segment of the public that believes that America's Funniest Home Videos was used, the impression that I get, as its soundtrack.
That's right. Who wrote that song?
It's not like a band. It's just some songwriter, like TV person. It's not like some guy on like Instagram did a whole deep dive into it and like found the songwriter.
I want to see that.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty interesting. But yeah, a lot of people think that's just in the impression that I get.
Yeah. I can understand if you're not paying attention. I can understand that. Like, it's a really obnoxious to assert that that's like the second most impactful ska song of all time. But like, in terms of if you want to talk about the most heard, like the most plays that one ska song has gotten, like every rerun of America's Funniest Home Videos for freaking 30 years or whatever, like I. Quantitatively, that's got to be up there. I thought you were going to tell me that was like Save Ferris or something, you know, but it's too bad. I hope they got paid off that.
I want to talk about the lyrics of this song. Or what this song, do you have any thoughts about what this song is about or what this song means to you, or does it mean anything to you?
Well, again, no, well, ah, is definitely my takeaway from the song overall. I think, and that's a very profound message, honestly, or it was to me as a freshman. I'm not a coward. I've just never been tested. I'd like to think if I was, I would pass. Like, I don't know the story, but I'm going to assume there's like a very specific personal like trigger to this. I find this song, this does mean something. It's kind of moving. It's honestly moving in that he's like looking at someone who's struggling or going through something and like wondering if he would have the strength to do that as well, right? Like even if I lightly make fun of it a little bit or whatever, like I do think, if you think about like most other alternative rock songs, like I don't know if there's that coherence, you know, and that compassionate a message to like your average alt-rock radio hit at that point. But it just, it does seem, it's very clear, it's very direct, and there's like an empathy to it, you know, that's like not oversold, but is like very present. Like, again, it just seems like he's looking at someone being like, I don't know if I would have the strength to do what they're doing. Like, and even that idea broadly is like, it's sort of an unexpectedly kind, you know, and human sort of sentiment to express, you know, in a song that's playing on MTV in 1997.
It's hard to think of other songs that express that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Like my friend's going through something, and I've never been through that myself. And, you know, I don't know if I could. Like, that's a very interesting sentiment.
Yeah.
A lot of people, though, find this song confusing because I've never had to. This is an interesting thing. I've never had to, knock on wood. That confuses a lot of people because they don't know that there's a comma there.
Oh, no, you said, all right, this is the comma.
The comma, the infamous comma.
I've never had to, comma, knock on wood. Wow. I had never. Okay. No, that does.
Yeah, see?
I had never considered that, but you're right. Okay. That completely changes the song. I'm serious. That's very important.
No, it does. It completely makes.
Yeah.
The song seems like maybe it doesn't make sense, but when you realize that he's interjecting, knock on wood, to not jinx.
Or parentheses, not. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because the whole verse is about dealing with the tragedy and this. And then he says, I've never had to, knock on wood.
Yeah.
But I know someone who has.
I think my interpretation was always close. Like, the chorus is asserting that when something bad happens to you, you have to knock on wood to try and get. Like, that doesn't work, obviously. But I think that I sort of man, that blows my mind, sincerely. Because it's totally right. I think that I somehow, it didn't make sense to me, the chorus, but I sort of assumed that the comma was there, I guess is the way I would put it. Like, I still got the gist.
You got the gist of what the song was about, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
But like, why did he phrase it that way?
Why did he phrase it that way? You know, but it's he can do what he wants. You know, if you can go like that, you can do whatever you want, in my opinion.
So Dickey wrote the song. He did actually write the song after attending a funeral for one of his close friends. The close friend had a funeral for their brother.
Oh, God, I knew you were going to say something like that. Yeah.
And so he was kind of like sympathizing with his friend, like, wow, you're having to deal with burying your brother. So that's something I've never had to deal with.
Yeah.
And so apparently he wrote the song like right after that experience.
Mm. That's really beautiful, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really sad, but really cool. You know, I think one of the underrated parts of this song is the outro. Yeah. Sort of the, you know, is it the trumpet? Is the trumpet the last?
That's a saxophone.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Do, 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 do. Like, it's, there's something just the last like 15 seconds and like the organ and like the song just like even Dickey's vocal sort of powers down. There's something I don't want to oversell it like it's funereal or whatever, but there's just the gentleness of the coda of the outro of the song, I think is a really cool, really unexpected thing. And just sort of ending on, I get, you know, ending with him. That's really cool. I've always really liked that part of the song. And, you know, the backstory sort of bolsters that for me.
Never had to, I better knock on wood. Cause I'm sure it isn't good. And I'm glad I haven't yet. That's the impression that I get.
Yeah, it's somber.
Yeah, it's somber. Thank you.
We'll be right back. After this,
what is the perceived tone in your opinion, though? Like, not thinking deeply about the song, like, what does the tone feel like to you? Does it feel like just a fun song, or do you kind of gather the somberness intuitively?
I think you gather the somberness intuitively. Like, it's ska, right? Like, it, yeah. You know, I just thinking about it in the context of listening to alt rock radio, you know, and I hear Stone Temple Pilots and I hear Bush and I hear Nirvana and I hear Pearl Jam, and then I hear this, right? And the ska-ness of it is what makes it pop out you know, but it's still got that distorted chorus, you know, it's still got Dickie going, you know, like there's, it belongs there, but it's objectively different at the same time. And the jauntiness, like the joy, you know, the upbeatness of ska is present in the song musically. But I do, you know, not knowing the backstory, not knowing you wrote it after a funeral, again, still, what I got from the song, you know, the lyrics, even if you don't understand the comma, which I didn't, and I'm very grateful to you for telling me about it. But like, again, I do think that you glean enough of the empathy of it, you know, that this is somebody trying to sympathize with someone who's going through something. And you know, I think that you get all that. And I think that what makes the song work is the contrast between the upbeat nature of ska, you know, and, you know, this sort of serious, you know, very human to human kind of message. You know, I think without even knowing the details, I think that you can glean enough of that to understand why this song is different, you know, beyond the horns and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I'm curious about from your point of view, now you've dove so deep into the 90s. I'm curious your perception of the context. We've kind of talked about it a little bit. You said that stuff like, you know, Fatboy Slim is where the critics assumed or wanted music to go at this era. You also talked about stuff like Stone Temple Pilots and all these other kind of rock bands.
Mm-hmm.
How did you see this song / ska's place in culture in the 90s, specifically like at this sort of 95, 96, 97 point of view?
Yeah, so this is like overbroad, like super general, right? But like the cliche that's kind of true, but kind of a cliche is like Nirvana changes everything, right? So like 80s, 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 Nirvana. Now it's the 90s. Like that's, and so from 91 to 94, it's grunge, right? You know, and so that's Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam. That's when Seattle is the biggest place on earth, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, 94, like we said, is when Dookie and Smash come out. That's when Kurt Cobain takes his own life. Like that's, there's still going to be grunge albums, but like grunge has peaked in this moment. And I think if you're talking about like the one biggest band on MTV, the radio, et cetera, I think Green Day takes over in 94.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that sort of carries us through into 96, 97. And what interests me about the 90s as a whole is like 97 and 99 is bizarre. Right. Like that's where you get like the one hit wonders and like the fluky kind of songs from this era just feel flukier to me. Like Sugar Ray's Fly is in this category, like a band, like they're a punk rock band and suddenly they're not, like surprise, you know, like this is where you get like Lens, Steal My Sunshine.
Classic.
This is when you get Chumbawamba. You know, it's just weird stuff starts happening and like alternative rock as a brand is dying, you know, as the next big thing, you know, teen pop is on the horizon. You know, that's how, you know, from 99 on, it's going to be teen pop, you know, even on MTV, you know, nu metal is sort of taking over from grunge. But there's right in this zone, you know, maybe starting in 95, it's sort of peaking from 97 and 99. In my head, it's just the weird, you know, this is where the Cherry Pop and Daddies, you know, this is where a neo swing movement can come in. And again, like maybe I'm overstating the degree to which they were stating it, but I felt like reading Rolling Stone, you know, in 96, 97, like, you know, the dude from Prodigy's on the cover, like they're talking up the Chemical Brothers and like the Crystal Method, you know, and they're just trying to predict where music is going. That is their assumption, you know, that it's going to get more electronic, you know, it's going to get more involved with dance music, with rave music, whatever. But it seems like a free for all in this period. And it feels like this is the time when on a mainstream level, like, you know, the mainstream gatekeepers can look at like a thriving, more regional scene like ska, like the Boss Tones, whatever. And like anything, anyone can suddenly be an MTV rock star for a little while. And there's always one hit wonders. There's always flukes. There's always stuff out of nowhere. But it feels like in this moment, it's especially out of nowhere. And I wonder if a little of that energy, like the vacuum that's been created, you know, benefits like Third Eye Blind and stuff like that, like Matchbox 20. Like there's a lot of different things happening, but there isn't one central focal point the way you had Nirvana in 91 or even Green Day in 94. Like it's the field is more open, I think. And I think that that does ultimately benefit the Boss Tones, you know, and this is where a hit can slip through and become suddenly huge, you know, because it's the field is wide open for some reason.
Yeah, definitely Nirvana changed everything. I mean, that's definitely not an overstatement. I mean, it really did, because like everything that existed in the 80s that was part of the underground, that was considered part of the greater landscape of punk culture, had no place in mainstream until Nirvana.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that kind of opened the doors for that. But Green Day as well opened the doors for anything actually directly part of punk culture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think that to some degree, ska benefited from that, because ska was sort of, well, parts of ska were in punk culture.
You know, Op Ivy, of course, you know, like there's a symbiosis from the beginning.
And it seems to me like it also enabled labels and MTV and all these other places to have a concept of how to market ska.
Mm. Yeah.
Ska had existed in the underground, you know, ever since Two Tone, and there was efforts for it to, you know, to succeed. You know, I mean, Fishbone and Untouchables were both signed to majors, but
yeah,
there was always this kind of confusion about how to market these bands. Like, and Fishbone infamously were, you know, considered like the greatest LA band of the 80s, and like nobody knew how to market them, and they had this huge support with their label. But I think with Green Day breaking and then them sort of going like Real Big Fish, Mighty Mighty Boston, Save Ferris, we can market it sort of like how we market punk, but a little bit more fun. That's my perception. I'm curious if that rings true to you as well.
I mean, punk but more fun works, you know, as four words, you know, to explain this, right? You know, like the other thing I sort of, you know, the other overgeneralization that I make is, you know, when Kurt Cobain dies, you know, when grunge sort of peaks, like what we want now is something brighter. Like I think about the Basket Case video, right? Like just the hyper saturated color and just Billy Joe's eyes in that video. I feel like that's what we wanted now. We did not want dour monochrome whining, you know, even though Green Day did plenty of whining, you know, but just like, even Longview, you know, a song about, you know, teenage languor or whatever and masturbation, et cetera. Like there's just a brighter tone, you know, there's a little less self-flagellation to it. And I think that that tone carries over, you know, I think that's why you get like this pop punk boom, why the Warped Tour, you know, it's just less dour. You know, like you think about like do like being one of the biggest things on the radio in 97. Like I don't think that's an accident. I do think that another quality that ska inherently has, like it's not vapid, you know, it's not like happy for no reason or whatever, but there's just an upbeat, you know, I'm just Rancid always popped to me on the radio, right? Like it sounds like these guys are having fun, you know, and as much as I loved, yeah, you know, Nine Inch Nails, like the whole value proposition of that guy is he's not having fun. Like it was just cool, you know, that the crowds were excited, that the music was upbeat, you know, like just knowing somehow that the Boss Tones were a great live band, you know, and their shows were so fun and so energetic, like all of that really helps. And I do think that you're primed, you know, society is primed for that kind of thing as well at the time that the impression that I get blows up.
Yeah, and I think something that's unique to the Boss Tones in the 90s, it applies to ska in general, but it especially applies to the Boss Tones, is that they very much saw themselves as entertainers, and they were very much like of the opinion that we're going to put on a show and people are going to have a good time. And it's not about how we look. It's not about how cool we look. It's about how much fun people are having. And I think that a lot of the rock bands, alt rock bands of the 90s, I don't think they were quite there. They cared a lot about how they looked, and they cared a lot about coming off a certain way. But you know, like you have the Boss Tones, it's like all just dancing, plaid. You know, you have Ben Carr on stage dancing. I mean,
exactly. The Pearl Jam did not have a designated on stage dancer, you know?
Like Nirvana tried to do that a little bit.
A little bit.
I would be so curious to see. I would be very curious to see how Nirvana would have evolved.
Yeah.
Sure.
I feel like they would have been a different band.
They would have, you know, it's, they would have made very confounding records.
Yeah.
You know, that like tainted their legacy. Like we would have done that whole thing, but it would have been fascinating. I completely agree. Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
As like a ska, as for people who are really into ska before ska was cool, how angry or skeptical were you when ska got cool? You know, you're not at the shows, you're not looking at the new people or whatever, but like, is there any like unease to this moment when the Boss Tones are suddenly huge, even if you're like good for them, right? Like, do you resentful of the carpetbaggers?
I'll answer your question by saying this. When I heard I'm Just a Girl on the radio in 2 years earlier, mm-hmm. I was furious. So, yes.
Furious. All right.
Furious. All right. And I was a really big No Doubt fan. Yeah, I love No Doubt, and I just could not believe.
Okay. All right.
I saw No Doubt like 3 years before that, and I loved them. I thought they were amazing.
Okay.
I couldn't believe that they did that to me. How dare they?
Yeah.
I had a similar experience with Goldfinger's Here in Your Bedroom music video. Like the aesthetic of that video just felt so, it felt like all the tropes of ska. It felt inauthentic to me as a teenager who was already immersed in that scene.
Right. I'm sure it was, quite frankly. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, who knows? Like, I'm not going to judge anybody else's artistic expression at this point, but as a shitty teenager, I was like, fuck this.
That's your whole job. As a teenager, it's your obligation to judge everybody's...
It's your obligation to hate on shit.
It's exactly. Exactly. That's hilarious. That's so cool. We don't get furious at songs anymore.
I know. Growing up. Overrated.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose people talk more about the Boss Tones dancing guy than they do the Happy Mondays dancing guy?
That's a very good question. I'm listening to a giant Bandsplain podcast about the Happy Mondays. I guess the answer is that the Happy Mondays, I think, were pretty confounding to America as a whole. Like, I think they did not break in the same way.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure you talk about this all the time, but just, it's like a joke, right? But the sheer number of people on stage at a ska show, right? Like just the visual of a horn section, like there's the Onion headline, like ska band outnumbers audience or whatever, like is one of my personal favorites, but just,
yep.
When you talk about the showmanship, you know, and the entertainer quality, like just the idea of a band with a horn section, that many people on stage at the same time, that's already very surprising to someone who's sort of raised on like guitar, bass, drums, you know, front man, you know, just sort of the monochrome view of what a rock band is. That's already been exploded by the Boss Tones, by the number of Boss Tones before you get to the dancing guy, right? And the dancing guy is extra like, holy, like, what is this? All it's all he does, that's cool. Like I don't, you have to be pretty cool in Ohio in 1995 to like know enough about the Happy Mondays to be like, oh, this is like the Happy Mondays, right? I'm gonna guess that for, you know, less urbane Midwestern teenagers, like he was your first exposure to a guy whose entire band, his entire job in the band is like dancing and like, you know, sort of cruise ship director or whatever, however he would self-identify his job.
Yeah. I think, you know, for a lot of people, he probably was, you know, motivating, like, wow, I could do that.
But see, I couldn't. I it's a shame. I'm ashamed to admit this on this podcast. I cannot skank.
You can't skank.
I cannot. I cannot coordinated enough. If I did it at like 0.25 speed, like I'm sure, like if I took several hours, I could probably approximate the movements of skanking at like half speed, but like I just, something in my head, it just doesn't click. I was in a ska band, and I'm saying this, I'm so embarrassed.
It doesn't matter what you do though. You could just, whatever you do is skanking if it's to ska music.
That's true. That's true. It matters to me when I do it, but you're absolutely right. Yes. It is a state of mind more than it is a prescribed series of movements. That's true enough.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slo Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Thank you for listening to our conversation with Rob, talking about 90s music and specifically the impression that I get. And if you want to hear more of this conversation, Aaron, tell them what they're going to do.
Well, you're going to find a little website called patreon.com, and you're going to backslash that and then put In Defense of Ska, and then you're going to sign up and you're going to throw money at it.
Oh, throw money at it.
It's throw money at it. And you're going to get so much content, like bonus content that only special people get.
Tons of content, tons of insider access, tons of fun for you, the defender of Ska.
And you know what else? You're going to be supporting a podcast that covers Ska.
Yeah. Hey, you know, this show is put together on a shoestring budget. You know, we do have some ads, but that doesn't really create a ton of revenue. Basically, where all the money comes from is from Patreon. So help cover our expenses, help cover hosting, help cover editing, help cover, you know, these microphones that we, you know, eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We're just chewing our way through microphones. So...
Wow, you just put a weird visual in my mind.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm here for.
I felt like that was like a real AI thing. Like it would be like a podcast host eating like a microphone for breakfast, because that's what AI thinks podcast hosts do.
Yeah, you don't need AI. You got me.
Yeah, all right. We got more with Rob. Sign up and listen to Rob talk about some stuff unrelated to the impression that I get. We kind of go in a different direction. And that's what we're going to be doing on these bonus episodes, these extended episodes, if you sign up to that Patreon. We're going to get something different than what the main episode has.